Well, now, at a slightly later time, and for one week only, Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest is the composer Anna Meredith.
Today we slightly break the mould. We don't normally have musicians because obviously their love of music is a public passion rather than a private one. So it's particularly nice to be able to have Anna Meredith, one of Britain's leading composers, coming up from the younger generation. She's hard to label. She composes and performs both acoustic and electronic music, and her work has been performed everywhere, from the last night of the proms to flash mob events in the M6 services. She studied at York University and the Royal College of Music, and alongside numerous awards, she's been composer in residence with the BBC's Scottish Symphony Orchestra and a judge for BBC Young Musician of the Year. She was recently commissioned as part of the BBC 10 Pieces initiative to write a work which will be played to primary school children across the country to introduce them to classical music. As I said, Anna, it's hard to categorise, which I think is a compliment, but I think the work which has probably really caught the popular imagination, perhaps more than any other, are your body of percussion pieces, where you ask musicians to put down their instruments and use their bodies instead. Just tell us a little bit about that.
I love the idea that you don't have to have musical training or that you don't need to own an instrument to be part of a piece. And I also love the idea that with body percussion you move. I think sometimes we can get so caught up as musicians staying still or keeping quiet. And so this was a piece that encourages young people to use things that are really innate to us, dance and movement and body percussion, where you hit your body or you swipe your arms, and also beatboxing, where you make drum sounds with your mouth. So it's a kind of exciting challenge. I had quite a limited palette of sounds, and so I just had to be creative with what I could do, whacking myself on the chest in my bedroom while I was trying it out. So this is Connected.
There is a primal kind of desire to make rhythms, isn't there? I mean, you see children with knives and forks at a table, for example. So it builds on something which goes back, I think, a long way in human evolution.
I think you're right. I think movement, I love dancing. It's something I sneakily do on my own every single day. I like to come home and put on music really loud in my headphones and jump about. I find that sitting behind my desk trying to compose can sometimes feel so unnatural. And so I think dancing and movement and any piece of music that moves me physically and viscerally, I love. If it actually makes me want to move, I'm in.
We heard part of Anna Meredith's Connected, performed by Drumworks, a youth percussion group from East London. You clearly, and I share this very much, get very fed up with labels, classical music, and because you cross between the two. Do you find the categories very unhelpful?
Yeah, I guess I do. I mean, I think people are going to always want to pigeonhole you for their own comfort, and there's not really that much you can do about it. But I think over time, I've just learned to that when I'm writing, whether I'm writing a dance piece, you know, a techno type thing, or a piece for an orchestra, or a piece for children, I approach it the same way. I use the same kinds of material. I use the same kinds of bits of software. And my composing technique is the same. So I think, for me, it doesn't matter what the outcome is. The kind of stuff that gets me excited musically is always the same. So I try to just ignore it as much as I possibly can.
Well, some of the things that got you excited in your own musical education, going right back to Edinburgh, have stayed with you because you've chosen one now, haven't you?
I have. I guess the thing that first got me excited music was playing in it, singing with it and performing. So, yeah, one of the first things I loved doing was singing.
This is a 16th century madrigal.
Yeah, we had an amazing teacher at my school who started, I say a school madrigal group, there was just three of us who loved singing. And I don't actually think we sung this particular madrigal then. We started doing the Silver Swan and other really lovely bits, but I then eventually found this piece and I just loved it. There's a harmony quite early on the piece that I'm completely obsessed with and listen to on a loop over and over again.
It's Draw On Sweet Night by Wilby.
Yes.
Thank you.
Draw on, sweet night, friend, unto those cares that do arise from painful melancholy. I imagine it's the painful melancholy that prompted those wonderful harmonies. You were saying as we were listening, Anna Meredith, that they had a kind of almost squeeze box, contracting and expanding feel to them, didn't they?
I think you think it's going to resolve or that the tension is going to release, and instead just one note tumbles into another and tumbles into another, and it just keeps bellowing, and there's a contraction and this sort of incredible breath quality, this kind of in-out sense of the energy, which I just love, that you think surely we've scrunched as much as we can, and then he manages to just keep scrunching the whole time, and I just love it. I think it's such beautiful pacing of that kind of harmonic progression.
Peter Phillips directed the Tallis Scholars in Draw on, Sweet Night by John Wilby. There's so much to learn from past masters, isn't there? I mean, do you feel that there are things that you hear something like that from the 16th century and it feeds, even perhaps subconsciously, slightly into your own work?
Yeah, definitely. I don't want to ever think I could only be inspired by a certain kind of period or a certain kind of music. I mean, to me, what I would take from that would be the pacing, it would be how to write for voices, or maybe something about the sense of direction through the line. That would be something I would get excited about and think might inspire how I might write something for voices.
One thing I'm dying to ask you, because I sometimes feel it myself, and I don't know if this applies to other composers, is that when I'm working on something, you sort of need to inhabit that sound world, and one's a bit nervous of trespassing too much into other sound worlds. You need to occupy that landscape. Do you find that?
I'm very careful when I'm writing about what I listen to. In fact, I listen to very little music. I find that if I'm trying to write a piece and I hear something, that I can be quite influenced, and sometimes it really rocks my confidence, and I need to be feeling pretty pumped to write something. I need to be feeling, you know, a couple of press ups, come on, let's go, if I'm going to write a piece. And I tend to avoid music unless it's music I'm really familiar with that proves another purpose. If it's something that makes me energised, or if it's something that makes me calm, or something that I like washing up to, or whatever it might be, that's a different function. But I tend to listen to more audiobooks while I'm composing, just to give myself that blank canvas for thinking of new ideas.
And do you like doing things like walking, getting away from the little black spiders on the
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's so easy to stay locked in your room, and I've had so many unhealthy days when I don't leave the flat, and you know, it's really bad. So when I've got to think of an idea for a piece, I take myself out on a walk around Ruskin Park in Camberwell, where I live, and I basically stride around the park like a weirdo, waving my arms and singing to myself, and I don't let myself come back to my flat until I've got an idea. So I basically make myself work it out, and then I kind of try to imagine the piece in real time. Once I've got a little nugget of an idea, I'll start to sing it through. So this is all pretty embarrassing, so it's probably pretty good that my neighbours don't hear me at this stage.
Now, not only singing, but clarinet playing was what you did at school, isn't it?
That's right. Clarinet is my main instrument, and I still play it today.
And this music, I think you played on the clarinet when you were at school.
Yeah, that's right. Again, we had a brilliant Edinburgh, an amazing school's music service, and a fantastic wind band. And wind band was sort of the first ensemble that I ever played with. And maybe some people don't like wind bands, they find them a bit stodgy or a bit homogenous, but to be honest, I can't even tell anymore. I just love this music so much. And maybe that's tied up with how much I loved playing at the time. And, you know, I played it so much. I've played every single clarinet part in this piece, and, you know, all the percussion parts too, I think. I just, it's a really great texture to be part of.
So it's the first movement of Gustav Holst's Suite in F. Thank you. First movement of Holt's second suite in F for military band. Wing Commander Eric Banks was conducting the central band of the Royal Air Force. It's important for you, Anna, isn't it, to carry on performing music as well as composing?
Yeah, I think it took me a while to work that out. I mean, I had quite a conventional musical training in some ways, you know, training to be a composer who writes stuff, hands it over to players and sits palm sweating in an audience listening to it happen. But over time, I've realised that how much I miss being part of the performance side as well. I don't think I'm an amazing craftsman as a composer. I don't think I'm someone who only just loves getting into the detail of a score. I love big brushstrokes and just thinking about the big ideas of a piece. And so while I love doing the score writing and the commission work, I really missed, yeah, performing and being part of that side too. So gradually I've made that part of my working life as well. So I perform with a band and as well as doing my normal commission work. And I love it. I do absolutely love it.
And you do it with the Camberwell Composers Collective, or you did, which you founded yourself about 10 years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. I met a group of other amazing composer friends, mostly all through the Royal College of Music where we studied. And we just had this feeling after college where the idea was that you just sort of sat around and waited for commissions. And I think feels a bit powerless at the time. And so we started to set up little gigs in a local jazz club in Camberwell and just try out experiments, little pieces that we'd play to friends and talk about really informally and present ideas. And it was a sort of testing bed for us all to try out new stuff. It's where I wrote my first electronic pieces and did first pieces of visuals. And it was a brilliant opportunity, and it's made some of the most important relationships for me.
Well, one of those is with the composer of our next piece.
Indeed, indeed.
Emily Hall.
Yes, Emily is one of my absolute best friends, and I've known her since York. And she, along with me, has gone on a real journey with her composing, and her music has taken a bit of a transformation. And over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, it's become so stripped back and so honest, and I admire it so much. It's very different to how I write, but I find her honesty and her braveness in how she writes and the emotional clarity of the music really inspiring.
Okay, so this is Emily Hall's setting of a sonnet by Toby Litt, which was commissioned by the London Sinfonietta in 2009 and was part of an installation at the Old Midland Goods Yard in King's Cross. So in fact, you've probably heard it performed in a derelict warehouse.
I did. I mean, I've heard it on a few times, but yes, that premiere was in a sort of this incredible installation in this massive space with Olivia Cheney, this folk singer with an incredible voice, and had this beautiful natural acoustic that I think it was an old sort of train yard, and it was so memorable. It has a musical saw in it, and Ollie Coates, a cellist, we've both worked with a lot, playing beautifully, and it's so pared back. I remember the performance so much, and it's a piece that's really stayed with me just because of the economy and also the situation, which was so memorable.
Star
Olivia Cheney performing Sonnet, accompanied by members of the London Sinfonietta, part of a trilogy of song cycles by Emily Hall to words by Toby Litt. And you can find details of all the choices by my guest today, Anna Meredith, on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Well, you clearly, Anna, gained a great deal from the support and collaboration with other composers, particularly women composers, as you've developed your careers. But I wonder, and this is, I always feel awkward about introducing this subject, but to what extent it is an issue for you being a woman composer, or maybe it's not at all?
It's something that I've thought a lot about recently, and I think if you'd asked me that maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I probably would have said I don't think there is an issue. I mean, I've personally never had any problems. I've been very lucky in how I've been encouraged by my family to write, and I feel very... free to, you know, give stuff a go and be brave. But I've started to think increasingly recently, especially the more I work with young musicians and school-age girl composers, and why, when I teach in things like the National Youth Orchestra, am I seeing less teenage girl applicants for teenage composer awards and or prizes or competitions, that kind of thing. And why is that? And I'm starting to sort of think about maybe the effect of not having many role models in a syllabus, so that when you learn about classical music, unless someone is specifically making a point about it, you probably don't really hear any music by women until you get to the 21st century. And I think that might have an effect on young creative writers of any genre. So yeah, I'm increasingly keen to try and at least encourage girls to feel that they can be creative and brave and write loud music or anything they want to do.
Do you ever find that audiences are surprised by your music and think it should be more, in quotes, female, whatever that is?
I've had that a few times. I mean, it tends to be pretty bombastic, you know, especially when I'm doing electronics. And certainly I've found that there's a surprise that women write their own production, that when I'm doing the electronics, I do all the computer stuff myself. And I think sometimes there's an assumption that there must be a guy somewhere behind the scenes who's working all the software magic. So yeah, I've had a few times either that assumption, or I've heard the phrase, doesn't sound very female, or what's a nice girl like you doing writing music like that kind of stuff. But you know, it just makes me laugh. You've got to laugh it off and just do the stuff that makes you excited, which for me normally tends to be big rhythms, big basses, and I don't see what being female's really got to do with that.
No, I quite agree. But yeah. And of course, in another side of the musical world, one thinks of the example of people like Kate Bush and Bjork, who have carved out a very idiosyncratic career, haven't they?
Exactly. And I think the adventurousness and the sort of storytelling and the commitment to their ideas, if you look at someone like Bjork, each album has got its own identity, its own collaborators, its own fashion, its own visual side. And I find that really inspiring. And I make sure I always play some Bjork and some Kate Bush to young women whenever I'm talking to them, because I think they're both as valid and as interesting to them as a piece of Beethoven or a piece of Stieg Reif or anyone. I think it's great to show exciting music making of any genre to young women.
Well, play a piece to this middle-aged man.
Yeah, well, this is Bjork's Unison, which is from her brilliant Vespertine album. And I think this is just an exquisite piece of songwriting. The production's by Matmus, and it's just got a lovely sense of shape to it.
Will always own my own private branch of this tree. You gardener, you discipliner, domestically, I can obey all of your rules and still
Unison from Björk's 2001 album Vespertine. I'm very glad to find that, like many composers, Sibelius is a passion of yours. Tell me what he means to you and this particular piece.
I love, this is Sibelius's fifth symphony, the last movement, and it's the pacing again. It's the way that the piece just bursts out the door and you're in it already. There's energy, that fizzing right from the start of the piece. And it just careers down this kind of slope. It feels like it's out of control a bit. But the way that he introduces the big famous theme that comes in, and it feels like suddenly you just, it's almost like you topple off the edge of the cliff and you're weightless and the gears change and everything kind of kicks into sort of half speed.
And he also does something rather extraordinary, which is he builds the momentum by drawing it back again suddenly. So you think you're just coming to that tune again, don't you? But actually, he holds back.
And this is a piece to me that has an idea of energy and an idea of space. And exactly like you say, it's the interaction between the energy of these running scale motifs and then this big swinging leapy motif that you hear in the horns. And I think he's really thought about the way to introduce those two and how to push forward, fast forward and rewind back to really give us a sense of propulsion that just drives the energy right forward.
Thank you. such an extraordinary ending. Six staggered chords separated by silence, perhaps one of the most beautiful musical sounds.
Yeah, I mean, you've gone on this big, fluid, relentless journey. There's been drive and energy right for the piece, and suddenly you get to the end and there's all this space, this unpredictable space. And I always associate the end of this piece with being in the car of my mum, and it was one of her, like, three tapes that she'd have in the car. And she'd always be going, "Isn't this a great piece, kids?" and trying to whack the steering wheel in time to those sort of stabs. And, you know, obviously she'd get it wrong like we all do, because you just don't know where they're going to be. And I love it. It's so brave at the end of all that direction to suddenly put these full stops staggered like that.
Does that music, which we heard played by the Finnish Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jukka-Pekka Saraste, the last movement of Sibelius's Fifth Symphony, does that music evoke for you, as it does for some people, landscape, like Vaughan Williams or Elgar does for other people?
I don't actually personally find landscape that inspiring as a kind of starting point. I'm more interested with the kind of energy, with what he manages to do with this fuse that's lit at the start of the piece and how he controls that. And I find the kind of, yeah, this control of the economy of the material really inspiring. So I know that there's other stuff that's at play, and you know, obviously anything that's helped him or anyone become the musician they need to be, great, but I'm less interested in that than I am in what he does with his material.
Nevertheless, Anna Meredith, you've actually used visual images in some of your concerts, haven't you?
Definitely. I work a lot with my sister. She's a visual artist called Ellie Meredith, and we do a lot together. I think that's because I do these big visual sketches for my pieces, and I tend to have a lot of adjective describing stuff. I might be wanting to write a piece that will be, I don't know, oily and murky but punchy, or I had one piece that was seals at a disco or something. You know, there'll be a little image that will really help me write the piece. And because it tends to be something that's, yeah, adjectives or a sketch, that's something she can work with as well. So it helps her to do visuals to accompany my music.
Richard Ayres, your next composer, is someone who actually does believe in creating what you might call animated concerts, doesn't he?
Richard's an amazing composer who likes to go beyond, I think, the regular sort of concert experience. There's always one element more to his pieces, whether that's how the players move or what they wear, or maybe there's a visual to it. This is his piece, In the Alps, which is a sort of, it's almost like a film. I played it to some friends the other day and they were gripped. It's the story that unfolds during this piece. And Richard's music is exuberant and crazy and hilarious and completely heartfelt. Sometimes I think people think it's pastiche or is it tongue-in-cheek, and it's not. He just loves expression and passion and honesty, and I find it so exciting to listen to. So this bit we're going to hear is sort of three-quarters of the way through the story, where we've been introduced to this character, a villager called Bobbly, who's represented through a bugle, and you'll just hear this amazing little bit of story as we get to hear Bobbly and then meet his love, who's up in the mountains.
Voice is Bobbly's bugle song, carried up by the wind from the valley far below. are both enchanted.
We heard Barbara Hannigan as the voice and Richard Ayres himself in part of his animated concert in the Alps with the Netherland Winds Ensemble. Your own work, Anna, has been described, this was The Guardian, as simultaneously hilarious, oddly moving and deeply unsettling, which is a striking trio of adjectives, hilarious, moving, unsettling. I wonder perhaps what matters more to you to make people laugh or to move them or to unsettle them. And I wonder what you do actually think about critics and whether you find them unsettling.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice combination of words. I wouldn't ever want to set out to be any of those things. But it's great, obviously, when you do something and someone seems to get the measure of it. And, you know, it can be a bit weird when suddenly someone says, actually, I love the way that you did something that you didn't set out to do. That can feel quite strange because the sort of function which you thought was so explicit suddenly isn't. But then, yeah, when you get negative criticism, it can be really undermining and it can be quite damaging. I mean, I've had, like everyone else, there's a wealth of stuff you can look for online and comments and blogs if you want to go there. And when I've done big pieces, I did a piece for Last Night at the Proms a few years ago. And because it's the Last Night at the Proms, there's, you get tons of outrage because you're writing a new piece. You know, I got actual physical hate mail, which was a bit of a shocker, and, you know, as well as numerous nasty other things. And you just have to pick yourself up and learn that it's other people's opinions and look for the support in the right places and find a way just to get over it, because otherwise you'll never step outside your door and you'll never pick up a pencil again and write a piece. You've just got to know that other people are going to have their ideas of what they feel you should do and set up the conditions to make yourself the most confident musician that you can.
Well, appropriately, your last piece is called I Am Not Afraid. I Am Not Afraid is by the Canadian composer Owen Pallett, who also plays the violin, keyboard and sings. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, Owen Pallett is someone who trained classically, but has basically since then been doing much more on the kind of alternative pop circuit. And film. And I think he's a brilliant songwriter and an amazing performer. I saw him a few months ago, and where he does either himself with his violin looped brilliantly. You know, sometimes loopy stuff can feel very layery, but this is unbelievable looping where the layers are so complicated that you don't realise they've built up in the way they have. And I just find the lyrical honesty of how he writes, and yeah, the sort of fearlessness, I Am Not Afraid, I guess, of the content and the material, really, really, really exciting. And, you know, he's someone else who I also feel is kind of at the edges of this and edges of that, but ultimately doesn't care. You know, he's just doing his own thing, and I find that's pretty cool.
Anna Meredith, for this and for all your choices, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would bear the confusion.
Owen Pallett's I Am Not Afraid from his 2014 album In Conflict. Michael Barclay's guest was the composer Anna Meredith. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. And you can download a podcast of that programme and many others if you go to the podcast page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the former SAS Sergeant Andy McNab. That's next Sunday at the usual time of 12 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Well, it's 2 o'clock now, and here's Lucy Skeeping with the Early Music Show.
Welcome to the show. It's International Women's Day today, an opportunity to celebrate the achievements of women all around the world. And here on the Early Music Show, we're making our own contribution by exploring the life and work of a rather remarkable 17th century woman who seems to have defied convention by breaking into male-dominated artistic circles. Some people have seen Barbara Strozzi as a proto-feminist, but we do really need to view her through the prism of her own time. And to help us, I'm joined by Laurie Strass, Professor of Music at the University of Southampton and co-director of Musica Secreta, who researches, writes about and performs music associated with early modern women. Laurie, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Now, I'm really looking forward to hearing about Strozzi and just how she sort of fits in the context of other composers of her time. But first of all, let's hear some music. What are we going to start with?
This is Merce di Voi. It's the first work in her first publication, the Primo Libro di Madrigali a due, tre, quattro, cinque voci of 1644. She dedicates this book to the Archduchess of Tuscany, but I think this is about Barbara herself. She professes gratitude and love to a lucky star. And she also expresses a hope that she will become a new Sappho. So it's really about her as a new composer launching herself onto the scene.
Oh,
thanks to you, my star of good fortune. The first song published by Barbara Strozzi, performed there by La Veneziana. So, Laurie, it wasn't particularly unusual for a woman to be a musician in the 17th century in Italy, was it? So what is it that makes Barbara Strozzi kind of stand out?
Well, certainly there were female singers and composers in the 17th century, as you say, but she is unusual because she was a published composer. Many women wrote music for themselves to sing and they distributed it in manuscripts, but they didn't have access to the commercial marketplace in the same way that Barbara did.
So when was she born?
She was born in 1619 in Venice. And Venice at the time was alive with music, both in private homes and also more public music and in terms of the early opera and in public gatherings.
Because in England, of course, we didn't have women on the stage at all in that period, did we? But in Italy, then, it was commonplace to have professionals?
Yes, indeed. There had been professional women on the stage since the middle of the 16th century, and even those very early actresses were skilled singers. They had to sing and they had to dance. So the notion of women singing together and singing in a semi-private setting was already part of the culture.
Well, I think it'd be interesting to hear kind of how she got started and what sort of music education she had. But I think we ought to hear another one of her songs first. This is again from her first collection, isn't it? And I think we've got three voices this time.
Yes, that's right. This is the Three Graces singing to Venus, and it uses that distinctive texture of three female voices, which was already part of the commonplace of Italian secular music at this time. They first upbraid and then they praise the goddess for concealing her beauty. And what I really like about this piece is that the opening is so madrigalian, as is the ending. They finish with this beautiful flourish with these complicated intertwined ornamentation, and that is really so characteristic of that three female voice sound.